Al will be forever the myth.
You're the king of kings, Al.
There's always a pecking order. The little peckers never mess with the big peckers. So I'm a rooster, and he's a chicken.
This episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast is brought to you by our sponsors, Old School Labs. All right, welcome everybody to another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, where we talk to the legends of bodybuilding, and we also talk about the history of bodybuilding, and I'm your host, John Hansen. And on today's show, we have one of my favorite guests, and I think one of a lot of people's favorite guests, Jerry Branum, a great writer, and used to write for Iron Man magazine. He's an expert on nutrition, but Jerry also has a big history in bodybuilding. He's been involved in bodybuilding since the early 1960s. And we've had Jerry on the show several times. He's a great guest because he's got a lot of great stories. And today we're sort of going to do another throwback episode. At the beginning of the year, if you remember, we talked to Jerry and we talked about the years 1968, 78, and 88. Well, today we're going to talk about the year 1977. And this was a really big year for bodybuilding because there was a lot of major events that happened in the sport that year. The movie Pumping Iron was released in January of 1977. And then Arnold's book, Education of a Bodybuilder, which was his first book, and it reached the New York Times bestseller list. That was also released in 1977. And Arnold went on a huge promotional tour for that book, doing a ton of interviews all over the country on TV and radio. And then later that year at the Mr. Olympia contest, which was in October 1st in Columbus, Ohio, this was the second year that Arnold and Jim Lorimer promoted the show in Columbus. And Frank Zane won his first Mr. Olympia that year. And it was also the first time they gave out the Sandow Trophy. So there was a lot of stuff going on in 1977, including the 1977 AAU Mr. America, where they had a big parade. The 1977 IFBB Mr. Universe, where Cal Skalak beat out Mike Mentzer by 1 point. And also Danny Padilla beat out Muhammad McAway in their rematch of the year before. And also Danny Padilla won the IFBB Mr. America. So a lot of stuff was going on. I think it was really the year where bodybuilding reached the media. And the media was very, very interested in bodybuilding. And I think the movie Pumping Iron had a lot to do with that. And also Arnold's promotional tour of his book had a lot to do with it. So we're going to talk about the year 1977 with Jerry Branum. And this was actually a two-part interview because we had so much to talk about. At the end of the podcast, I am going to read another article. I know we skipped that last week because I wasn't feeling very well, but I'm back to normal now. This is from the May 1977 issue of Muscle Builder magazine, and it was an article written by Janet Charlton, and it was about Arnold when he won the Golden Globe Award, and it's called The Smallest Trophy He Ever Won. So it was a really good article, and I believe Janet Charlton wrote several articles for Muscle Builder, but she was a mainstream writer that wrote for a lot of mainstream magazines and sort of discovered bodybuilding around 1976, 77. And she wrote a few articles for Muscle Builder. So that's going to be a really interesting article. And I want to mention off the bat that we are brought to you by our sponsor, Old School Labs. I've been with Old School Labs for several years now. This is the supplement company that draws on the wisdom of the golden era of fitness and bodybuilding to offer unique supplements for the discerning athlete. Old School Labs is the only brand that I use, trust, and associate my name with. It's the brand that I used to win the Natural Mr. Universe and the Masters Division in 2012. You may have heard of their award-winning Fat Burner Vintage Burn, which is the world's first muscle-preserving fat burner, or Vintage Blast, their two-stage pre-workout, or Vintage Brawn, which is the triple protein isolate powerhouse. It's packed with eggs, milk, and beef protein. Their products have no proprietary blends, no artificial flavors, colors, or sweeteners. Old School Labs is also the home of 1983 Mr. Olympia Samir Banute and bodybuilding legend Tom Platz. So use the discount code LEGENDS12 and you will get 12% off your order when you go to oldschoollabs.com. Old School Labs, supplements that make sense. All right, and I am finally back to working out this week. Man, that cold that I had, which I thought was going to last a couple days, ended up lasting like 2 weeks, and I tried to go back full force this week, and man, it just didn't work out. So I just played it cool and went sort of moderate all week, so I'm finally feeling good. It took literally 2 weeks to get back to normal, so I guess when you get older, it takes a longer time to recover from these colds. Our interview with Joe Means last week was very popular. I didn't think Joe Means was very well known, but a lot of people were really interested in this interview, and they really liked the interview, including Bodybuilding Nerds Radio. Scott McNally talked about it last week, and he really liked it, especially the story about Arthur Jones and the crocodiles. And on my Facebook page, I got a few comments here. Pete Tingle, one of our loyal listeners, "This will be awesome. I remember Joe, very good bodybuilder that was always in fantastic shape. And any article about the myth is sure to be great." Richard Perillo said, "Outstanding. I'm really looking forward to this podcast with Joe." And then he said, "Excellent interview, as I thought it would be." Steve Sushana said, "Fantastic." Roger Schwab said, "Class," with an exclamation point. Chuck Zamzow said, "Great look." Bobby Faircloth said, "Joe was a South Carolina legend." Mike Gustafson said, "Another great podcast." Matthew Owen said, "Outstanding physique and photo." Joel Preston said, "Great physique." Anthony Chen said, "Joe, you are the greatest. Around 1970, I'm giving you 5 stars. And Artie Lamparella said, "Always in condition like Richard Baldwin and Annabelle Lopez. They packed maximum muscle on their frames." All right. So thank you for those comments. If you guys have any comments about the show, please send them to me at naturalolympia@gmail.com, and I'll read them on the air. And also, as I mentioned before, if you're listening to the show on iTunes, if you could please go where the show is and under there leave a review and rate the show, I would really appreciate that, because I guess that helps us reaching other listeners. I also want to mention, I think I mentioned this before on the show, I'm reading this book called Mr. America, which is written by John Fair, and it's really, really interesting book. I'm probably about almost up to page 200 in the book. And they go over every Mr. America contest. But in addition to that, they also go into like the backstage stuff that was happening between Bob Hoffman and Joe Weider, which was really interesting. These guys were feuding for literally decades. I mean, just going back and forth in the magazines. It seemed like the IFBB, which I really wasn't aware of, was not really going on until the 1960s, even though they said the IFBB started in the 1940s. They might have started the IFBB organization, but they weren't really having any big contests at all. And they've kind of looked up to the AAU Mr. America, which was the contest to enter. And besides that, the NAVA Universe was also a really big show over in London. Joe and Ben Weider were going back and forth trying to associate themselves with the AAU. And then they were trying to run their own show. And then they tried to go back with Bob Hoffman. And so it was really a huge feud going back and forth. And it was also interesting seeing how they judged the Mr. America contest, because when they started this contest, they were kind of basing it off the Miss America beauty contest, and they were trying to determine the ideal man in America. So it wasn't really just a bodybuilding contest. It was also based on your personality, your poise, how you carried yourself, your intelligence, and also your athletic ability. So for many years with the Mr. America, these guys had to do weightlifting, the actual Olympic lifts, and their totals were entered into their score for the Mr. America. So a lot of times in those early Mr. America contests, you had guys who were not the most muscular bodybuilders and not the best physiques, but they're all around with the personality and also their lifting totals. That's what determined the winner. So there was a lot of controversial winners in the beginning. Sometimes they picked the right guys, like obviously Steve Reeves. John Grimmick was one of the first winners, and Bill Pearl. Those guys were very popular winners, but a lot of the other winners were guys who really didn't have the best physique. So it's very, very interesting. I recommend it if you want to learn more about the history of the sport. It's called Mr. America. I bought it on Amazon, and the author is John D. Fair. And speaking of working out, I got an email here from a guy named Mike, and I was helping Mike out with his program. I wrote him out a new program and diet for my dadbodtoripbod.com website. And he wrote me back and he said, "Hey, John, the program is awesome. I weighed in this morning. I lost 3 pounds and my muscle mass is up from last month. Your workout was on the money. The only thing I can't do is eat the first meal at 4:15 in the morning. It's too early and I have no appetite, but it's really no big deal. I usually don't eat until 10 a.m. anyways. I still go to the gym 5 days a week. But so far, so good. Thanks, John." So that was a great email I got from Mike, and he was only on the program for a couple of weeks, so I'm glad it's really working for him. If you guys are interested in a workout or diet, just send me an email at naturalolympia@gmail.com, or you can go directly to the website, which is dadbod2ripbod.com. All right. And here is our interview with Jerry Branum, part one of our interview with Jerry, where we talk about the year 1977, which was a real groundbreaking year in the world of bodybuilding. Here we go. All right. Welcome back to the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. And today we are joined again by one of my favorite guests, Jerry Branum, who used to be a writer for Iron Man magazine and for Joe Weider. And today, Jerry, we're going to, well, last time we had you on the show, Jerry, we got such a positive response. We were talking about, I think, 1968, 78, and 88 going into the new year. So today I wanted to talk about the year 1977. And this is kind of a personal thing for me because this was the year that I actually started bodybuilding. So this was the year that I started bodybuilding, and I think it was kind of a real pivotal year for bodybuilding because it was the year that Arnold came out with his first book, and then Pumping Iron was released, and it really seemed like the media was really getting a hold of bodybuilding. There was a lot of publicity about bodybuilding that year.
Correct. That was also the disco times, you know. When I think of the late 70s, the first thing I think of is disco, you know.
Right.
Disco, you know, Donna, what's her name? Donna Weaver?
Donna Summer.
Summer and all that stuff. Yeah. And I know, to me, those were really good times. You know, I was in my late 20s and had a really good time in those years. I mean, I was training at Gold's Gym and all that, but I remember that. The 1977. Yeah, I do remember that year. I knew all the top guys that were competing. You know, I could tell you, I hadn't started writing for the magazines yet. Okay. I started writing for Joe Weider. Well, actually, I did a little work from starting around 1981, but I officially started writing from when the very first issue of Flex magazine. I had articles in the first two issues. That was when I officially started writing for Joe. And okay. I wrote from, of course, all the way up into the late 90s. And I was a science editor for 10 years. But what I was doing in the late 70s, you might find this interesting. I was writing, ghostwriting bodybuilding courses for some bodybuilders. Yeah, I wrote Bill Grant's courses.
Okay.
Now, who else did I? I think one or two other guys who I don't even remember. You know, I just... they were friends of mine. Most of the time, I didn't even get paid for it, to tell you the truth. I just did it as a favor.
Right, because you could write.
You know, these guys, you know, they, you know how it was. I mean, Joe Weider wasn't paying them much money. And, you know, the only thing he would give the guys were ads in the magazines. You know, he'd give them ads for their courses. So I tried to help them out, to help them make a little money. And I felt bad because, you know, these guys, as... You know, there was no cell phones. Everybody really worked hard though in those days.
Yeah,
it was,
yeah.
You know, John, we've talked about this. There was no fooling around. You know, everybody, I said on Facebook the other day, I pointed out how the original Gold's Gym, it was strange because, you know, it was very famous for all the bodybuilding champions. I'm talking the one on Pacific Avenue, the very first Gold's Gym.
Yeah.
You know, Arnold, and you had Franco and all these other guys, Robbie Robinson, Frank Zane, Dave Draper. But you had a lot of people that were not top bodybuilding champions, but the commonality was strange. This is going to sound strange. Everybody made progress.
Yeah.
And not everybody became a bodybuilder, but when a guy joined that gym, like you see him 4 or 5 months later, if it was a fat guy, he lost weight. If it was a skinny guy, he gained some muscle.
Yeah.
Because it was two things. It was the gym atmosphere. It wasn't a big place, just one big room. But everybody was very serious. There was no cell phones. There wasn't even any music. They just had a little radio sitting at a desk.
Okay.
And the gym, they had nothing. So all you could do is literally train hard.
Right.
You know? And I compare that today when you see all these people. I mean, I went to Gold's the other day, and I just for the hell of it, I counted about 98% of the people in the gym. I'm not exaggerating. 99%. We're walking around with cell phones.
Wow, unbelievable.
And of that, I'd say about 5%, where they were actually using the cell phones to listen to music while they were training. There's no problem with that, right? Mm-hmm. But the others, they would do a set and they'd sit on a bench, and I could see over the shoulder, they're playing, they're looking at Facebook and Instagram.
Yeah.
And they're resting like 20 minutes between sets.
I know. I see it all the time, too.
It takes all my willpower not to go up to them and say, you know, pal, you should just stay home. You're not going to make any muscle gains at all.
The truth is,
they never do.
No,
they will never change. It's just the opposite of the original goal. The fat guys stay fat. The skinny guys stay skinny. And what gets me, I think Albert Einstein was famous for saying, The definition of insanity is making the same mistake over and over again. Right. And these people, you know, they never stop to think, why aren't I making any gains? I mean, right. I'm sure you were this way. When I was younger, if I didn't make gains, I'd start to go crazy. I'd say, wait a minute, I must be doing something wrong. Why aren't my arms growing?
Right.
How come my abs aren't? I want to make changes immediately. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, exactly.
I guess it must be the whole world. I have no explanation for
Well, Jerry, let's talk about Pumping Iron first. In January of that year, the movie Pumping Iron was released. Right. And it was kind of a small art house film. But, of course, now here we are over how many years later. And it's a classic film. It's the classic bodybuilding documentary. It had, of course, Arnold Schwarzenegger in it, and Lou Ferrigno, and Franco, and Mike Katz, and Ken Waller, and Ed Corney. So, what did you think about that movie when it came out? Did you get to see it at the theater?
I did get to see it at the theater, and I knew about it. Of course, it was interesting because when they filmed Pumping Iron, that was filmed at the original Gold's Gym.
Yeah,
that's where I worked out. I just happened at the time of the filming. I happened to be visiting New York for a couple of months. So I was in New York when they were filming out here. Or if I had been out here, I probably would have been in the film in some capacity, at least, you know, being seen training in the gym. I was actually, this is the ironic part, the gym I was training at in New York was the East Coast gym where they filmed Pumping Iron, which was called R&J Health Studio.
Oh, okay.
Avenue in Brooklyn, if you think back to the film, that's where they filmed Louis Ferrigno training with his father. That's the gym where I was actually training. But even further, another further ironic fact is when the camera guys came in the gym, I happened to not be there either.
Oh, man.
So you know, I kind of like regret that because I could have been, you know, in either place.
Right.
I trained in both gyms, yet I was never I wasn't even in the movie. Happened to be there at the time, you know. I think in Brooklyn, I think I was coming in later in the day. They were filming in the morning. That's why I missed it.
Okay.
You know, but of course, you know, the best thing, the thing that stands out about the Pumping Iron film, as you know, it was based on a book.
Yeah.
You might have to correct me in that. Did the book come out first or was it the movie?
Yeah, the book came out in 74, so.
Now, the book was very exciting. Charles Gaines and George Butler, you know, who was it? I think it was Gaines was the writer.
Yeah.
Charles Butler was the photographer. I mean, great photos. I mean, real candid photos. I think it was it Leon Brown on the first cover? Was it Leon or
no, it was Ed Corney?
Ed Corney.
Yeah.
And you know, it's really exciting. It was very well written and it got a very good response. I mean, people that never heard of bodybuilders, because of the elegance of Charles Gaines' writing and the beautiful photos taken by Butler, people read the book who had no idea that bodybuilding existed, or they had the usual preconceived notions of the era, which was that bodybuilders were all brainless homosexuals who lived and slept in the gym and didn't do anything else and were kind of stupid or whatever.
Right.
This book changed the mind. So based on that, Butler and Gaines decided to make the documentary, and they decided to feature, of course, Arnold. And, you know, when you make movies, the first rule of script writing, anyone can tell you, is you have to have conflict. You have to have a challenge.
Yeah.
Every script has to have, if you think about it, every TV show, every movie always has to have some sort of conflict or challenge. Otherwise, there's nothing to, you know, you only have like an hour to 2 hours. Some movies are longer than that. But in every the commonality, always conflict, right? So they decide, they had two conflicts in their Pumping Iron movie. The first, of course, was between Arnold and his challenger, Lou Ferrigno, right? And the second one, now here's the interesting part that I don't know if a lot of people know this. The conflict, if you want to call it that, friendly conflict, between Arnold and Louis was real. In other words, Louis really wanted to beat Arnold. And the strange thing was that Arnold was actually Louis's idol. They don't kind of focus on the movie. Louis really looked up to Arnold, right? But he still wanted to be, because, you know, he's a kid, he wanted to be the top guy. Now, the second conflict in the movie was between Mike Katz and Ken Waller,
right.
where Ken Waller was portrayed as this evil guy, whereas Mike Katz was this loving dad. They showed him with his kids, and he was a big, soft-spoken guy that, you know, when he was waiting for the results, he's thinking about, oh, I wonder what my kids are doing. You know, they made him this real nice guy.
Yeah.
And Ken is the most nasty guy in the world, who actually hid not only Mike Katz's T-shirt, but also his crusher, the thing that they use. It's kind of went like that.
Right, right.
Those days, they used to use it to pump up their pectorals. I don't think it really did anything. But you know, the part that's laughable is that conflict was entirely made up in the film. In other words, the thing about Ken Wallace peeking around the corner, he wasn't even looking at Mike Katz. That was all manufactured because he wanted to, include some conflict. And what I find really funny about all that is that for years after this, Ken Wallace has said this himself, people would boo him. They'd curse at him because, Mike Katz seems such a sweet guy that Ken Waller, you evil bastard. Why did you do this? he's a dad. How could you do this to the poor guy?
Right.
You won the contest. He didn't even win. What else? And Ken Waller, he got really – he went along with it when they made the movie. But afterwards, he actually got really mad for a couple of years because he said it was all false. Nobody believed it. It was all – it was the way they filmed it. It never really happened.
Yeah.
He didn't hide his T-shirt. That was nonsense,
Yeah.
But I mean,
what did you think of the movie, Jerry, when you saw it?
I really liked it. I thought it was great. I thoroughly enjoyed it. It was well done. It was funny. I could tell you a funny story about Mike Katz, by the way. Right around that time, Mike Katz was he lived in, I believe, in Connecticut. He was East Coast. I believe at the time, I think he was a school principal, if I remember. I don't remember exactly what he was doing. But, he's a former football player. He played for the Jets in New York. He comes out. Now, Mike Katz was a big guy. He had this big chest. I competed in shows back east when I was a teenager, where I was in the teenage show and Mike was in the senior show.
Okay.
But the funny thing is I had never spoken to him, even though we competed in the same show, like when I was in Massachusetts. So he comes out here, and I happen to overhear this conversation. Do you remember Szabo Kaczewski? Irvin Szabo Kaczewski, who was a denizen of Gold's good friend of Joe Gold. He was kind of like the unofficial manager of Gold's, Szabo. Mike Katz goes up to Szabo. I was like within earshot. I heard the whole conversation. And he says to Szabo, now you have to understand, Mike Katz, he had this kind of, he was a very nice guy, but if you look at him, he was a little bit scary looking. He had this kind of, he said Pumping Iron, he pointed out in the movie how when he was a kid, people would make fun, the kids would make fun of him, would call him names. So, in other words, his looks didn't match his person. He was a very intelligent, nice guy. Anyway, he goes up to Szabo Kaczewski and he says, "Hey, Szabo, is it safe to walk around here? I heard these streets in Venice say, you heard that, it could be a little dangerous." Szabo looks at him, he says, "Are you kidding me?" He says, "You look like Frankenstein." People will take one look at you and then run the other way.
Right.
Because the way they portrayed Mike Katz in the movie as a sensitive guy, that was not fiction. That's the way he was. Because when I looked at Mike Katz's face when Szabo said that, he actually looked hurt. He looked like he was about, his jaw dropped. He looked like he was about to cry.
Right.
He couldn't believe Szabo said that to him. But then Szabo laughed and Mike Katz laughed. It was forgotten. It wasn't, wasn't taken. But I remember when I saw the movie, I remembered that incident, which happened shortly before the movie was made or came out. And I said to myself, well, they sure got Mike Katz's personality because that's the way he is. He's a very sensitive, nice guy. That's the way he was.
Yeah.
But the movie was great. I like the fact that, they focused on Louis and Arnold training. It was terrific because you never saw that before, where you actually see the pro bodybuilders train for a contest. They had, of course, photos in the magazines back then, but you never actually saw them working out. And it gave an opportunity for bodybuilders all over the country, like yourself, to see the guys, the top champions of the day. Serge Nobre was there. Paul Grant from Wales.
Yeah.
You've seen him. He was a very nice guy, great guy, very muscular. Sadly, he died of kidney disease years ago, but a terrific guy. So all the guys training. And my point is it was a very inspirational film. And I believe that film probably got more people involved in bodybuilding than even the Hercules Steve Reeves movies, which were one of my early motivations. The Hercules movie, which came out around, I think it came out in 1959. It was made in 57. Okay. I saw it when I was 12 years old, now a couple of years later. But I remember going to the movies and looking at the sea of raisins, and I was sitting there with my jaw dropped the whole movie. I couldn't believe a human could be built that good.
Yeah.
And I'm not gay, but when I looked at Steve Reese, I said, my God, this guy is the best looking guy.
Yeah.
His face, you know, it right. doesn't look real. How can anybody look that good? I said, yeah. His hair and the way his beard was.
Right.
This guy is literally magnificent, you know. Pumping Iron inspired people in another way because, you know, you could see the guys training hard in the gym. They were, you know, but Arnold still, and this is true, by the way, you know, they showed in the film, Arnold always retained his sense of humor. This is one thing about Arnold. Even when he was dead serious, in the last 3 months, he trained what they were showing in the gym. That was the last 3 months before the Olympia. Arnold would intensify his training 3 months before the Olympia. The rest of the year, he'd kind of slack off. He trained about four times a week, maybe a half hour workout, just to stay in shape. But 3 months before the Olympia, he got very serious. But the funny thing is, and they showed this in the film, he never lost his sense of humor. He always kidded around and joked throughout the workout. He made the workout fun. And, you know, when you see the guys laugh, that was real.
Yeah.
He did that all
yeah.
the time. That was not portrayed in the film.
Yeah.
That was real.
Yeah. Yeah, can you imagine the self-confidence he had? Because he just got off filming Stay Hungry, and he
right.
came to California. He only had 3 months to get ready for the show, and he
That's
was
right.
down to 210 pounds. So he had to gain all that weight, and
right.
it was all being filmed. So his career was on the line. You know, if he lost the contest, it really would have been embarrassing.
True.
And he, like you said, he was very confident the whole way through. There was no doubt in his mind he was going to win.
Well, you see, the thing about Arnold is first of all, he was very confident. And the second thing that you have to take into account was Arnold really had little doubt that he would win because, you know, I guess we're going to talk about Danny Padilla a little later here.
Yeah.
But Danny Padilla and Arnold shared a trait which I haven't seen in that many bodybuilders, meaning that they could show up at the gym completely out of shape. And in Arnold's case, he was never completely out of shape. When he went down in body weight, like you say, about 10 pounds, you know, he basically lost his delts. His pecs wouldn't look very good. And his legs were really skinny, downright
yeah.
skinny. But he always had the biceps, always had the big calves. And he would change, John, literally day to day. I mean, within a month, this guy was already practically ready for the Olympia. But he wasn't quite hard enough. The hardness and the muscularity would come on the second month. By the third month, he was Mr. Olympia about 3 weeks before the show. He was
wow.
unbeatable.
Yeah.
All he did is maintain that up to the show. He did this every time. And, you know, because he had done it so many times before, he, in other words, it was almost like, you see, the guys back then, like Frank Zane, Arnold, all the guys, they had a kind of a blueprint. Some of them had a literal blueprint in the fact that they kept training journals, like Frank Zane, Bill Pearl. They actually wrote down every exercise, every set, every rep they did from the start of their career. Others, like Arnold, the blueprint was in his head. In other words, he knew what worked for him. He didn't have to mess around. He didn't have to experiment with different exercises, different diets. He knew exactly what worked for him, see? And that's why these guys were able to do that. In other words, you know, and I always recommend it in my Applied Metabolics News when I write about this stuff. I say that you should do this yourself. You know, note what works best for you and retain that information. Experiment with different things. After a while, you'll discover the unique style of training and diet that works best for you, not for John, not for Jerry, but for you.
Right.
That's what bodybuilders have to do if they want to be successful.
Yeah, exactly.
And I'm not telling you when to take drugs, but it also goes for the drug regimes because even with the drugs, certain drugs work better for some people than others.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen this over and over again. And I always tell the story about how I watched Arnold go through about 15 training partners in his heyday. And, you know, Arnold was generous with his drug information. In other words, he would tell the guys exactly what he took. He wouldn't even try and hide it. He'd say, you know, in fact, he actually did it, you know, do the drugs right in front of the guy. I saw that a couple of times.
Yeah.
And, you know, and the thing is, all these guys trained with Arnold. They followed his exact sets, reps, exercises, same drugs. None of them ever approached Arnold.
Yeah.
One very simple reason, because Arnold's regime worked for Arnold. It doesn't necessarily work. I'm not saying the guys didn't look good.
Yeah.
And Courtney looked terrific, and quite a few other guys' strength. I saw a guy come in from England, you might remember, named Frank Richard.
Oh, yeah.
He had huge back. He's the one that basically talked Arnold into doing one-arm dumbbell rows. Arnold had never done that for back. But he looked at Frank's gigantic lats. And he said, okay, I'm going to do it. And I remember him and Frank Richard doing one-arm dumbbell rows.
Huh.
You know, so, you know, but in other words, he basically found what works best for him. But the Pumping Iron movie was, I got a kick out of it because, you know, it was basically, of course, it was a documentary, but most of it was real. The only thing that was manufactured was, you know, the conflicts, you know, they kind of exaggerated the conflict between Louis and Arnold and this and that, not to a great extent, but, you know, with our, and another thing that was false was this thing about Louis' dad training him.
Yeah.
His name was Matt Ferrigno. He was a retired police lieutenant with the New York Police Department. And the thing is, he never trained Louis. That was strict for the movies. You know what
yeah,
I mean?
Yeah.
In fact, Louis talks about that in public now. He mentions how that was completely manufactured scene. But there's a funny, I don't remember, there's one scene that everyone in the movie theater laughed. If you remember this scene, Matt Ferrigno is training Louis, right, in the R&J Health Studio.
Yeah.
And he's helping Louis do a set, and Louis going, you know, he's really straining hard. And then Matt Ferrigno, who's not doing anything, he has a towel around his neck, takes the towel away and says, whoa, that was a tough one.
Right.
he didn't do anything. Right. Louis said, he's straining. And Matt Ferrigno says, that's a tough one.
Right, right.
It was hilarious.
That was funny.
Yeah.
Well, you were in New York. Did you get to see that Whitney Museum thing when they brought out, you know, Arnold and Franco and or not Arnold and Franco, Arnold and Zane and Ed Corning? They closed it at the Whitney Museum of Art.
No, I didn't see that. I didn't even know it existed until afterwards, actually.
Okay, all right.
But I found it very interesting because when you look at the photos, this was a rare thing in those days because all the guys were. Can you hear me? Okay.
Yeah, I'm good.
Yeah, all the guys, including Arnold, were off-season shape. They weren't in their top shape, and it's very evident in photos. I mean, Frank Zane, his usual, you know, diamond hard ripped body wasn't there. I mean, it's not that the man didn't look good, but he certainly looked. He was like 50% of his best shape.
Yeah,
hardly had any pec development.
Yeah,
all the big arms, and when he did the back pose, all that separation that he shows in the contest was not there at all. I mean. You know, what people saw, what they didn't realize, but I can tell you, is what they were looking at, or with those bodybuilders at the Whitney, they were looking at what bodybuilders look like off drugs.
Yeah.
Because this was off season. And back then, I can tell you, the guys never used steroids or any drugs off season. They only used it before a contest. Mm-hmm. So what you were looking at was the way they looked off drugs.
Yeah.
So anyone who wants to see what Arnold and Ed and Frank look like, well, just look at the photos in the Whitney. That's what they look like, off drugs.
Yeah. Hey, let's talk about the 77 Olympia that year. That was the first year that Frank Zane won, and then Ed Corning got a great ovation because of Pumping Iron. People were looking forward to him, and then he got like two standing ovations. And then you had Robbie was coming up, and a lot of people thought Robbie was going to win, and he ended up taking second.
Yeah.
And you also had a lot of people thought Ferrigno was going to be a top contender, but then Ferrigno ended up not going in it. But that was a really, really good contest, a really good Mr. Olympia, and it was covered by Y World of Sports. Mm-hmm. And it was, I think, the second time they had it in Columbus. So that was a really, really good Mr. Olympia contest.
Right. Well, I can tell you why Louis didn't compete, because Louis had planned to compete, but what happened was they were casting a TV show based on a popular comic called The Incredible Hulk.
Right.
And the original – it's a really funny story. The original guy they cast as The Incredible Hulk was – you got to think back. Do you remember the guy who played Lurch on The Addams Family?
Sure.
The way The Incredible Hulk – if you ever looked at the comics like I did when I was a kid – The Incredible Hulk, and they show this in the current films about he was a really big guy, and when the human morphed into the Hulk, he grew. He got not just bigger muscles, but he was like 9 feet tall, something like that.
Right.
So the casting director said, well, we need to get a really tall guy. So the guy they originally cast was this guy who played Lurch on The Addams Family. I can't remember his name. He was also in Butch Cassidy and Sundance Kid. I can tell you a funny story about that guy in a second.
Richard Keel was his name, I think.
I know Richard Keel was one of them, but they also had – I just remembered his name. Ted Cassidy, his name was, right?
Okay.
But when they were looking at Ted Cassidy, I guess the daughter or something like that a son, I can't remember.
The son.
Who was related to one of the casting people, looked at the photo of let's say, Lurch or Cassidy, and he said, wait a minute, Dad. This guy doesn't. The Hulk has muscles. This guy has no muscles. You can't cast him.
Right.
You know. remember, they didn't have the great CGI and the prosthetics to make like they do today. You see the guys who play Batman, they put on this muscle suit
right.
where they take a guy who has literally no muscle at all, like he could rival stand on the Mr. Olympia stage.
Right, right.
It's a rubber suit or whatever. Right. They didn't have prosthetics like that back then. So you had to have some kind of physique. So the casting director said, you know, the kid's right. We got to go find somebody, maybe one of these bodybuilders. So they looked around. They needed a guy who was really tall. The tallest bodybuilder they could find was 6'5" Lou Ferrigno.
Yes.
So Louis was, I think he was might have been working in Ohio as a steel worker or something like that, if I remember correctly, or something like that. Anyway, he went for the casting call and got the role immediately. So that's why he didn't compete in the Olympia, because you know he was in 5 years. He did the TV Hulk show. He became a household name. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But you know, Louis, of course, never lost his love for bodybuilding, and he tried to make a comeback in that Masters show many years later. He was over 40 years old. Looked very good. I mean, got tremendous shape. You know, but as for some of the other guys, I can tell you that it was an interesting situation between Frank Zane and Robbie Robinson. Because, of course, you know, Frank's forte was being ripped and shredded. Robbie was also ripped and shredded. Robbie had much more muscle mass than Frank. Mm-hmm. But Robbie had this weird thing in those days where he looked good in every other contest that he competed in. He, like, won the Night of the Champions, the first one, I believe it was, all these other contests. But when he showed at the Olympia, he always had, like, a light water retention around him, you know?
Yes.
And it's not that he looked bad, don't get me wrong, but he didn't look ripped. And Frank did. So this is a question of Frank winning the contest because he was just like the same reason he beat Arnold at the 68 Mr. Universe in Miami. Frank had the more finished physique. And to this day, it's not quite as controversial as the 80 Olympia, but people argue that Robbie should have won anyway because he looks so much bigger than Frank. Mm-hmm. I mean, his arms, his back was wider, and you know, it depends on how you look at it, but Frank did win. Of course, he won it 3 years in a row, 78, 79. So,
What was interesting was I got into bodybuilding that year, so I was reading Weider's magazine every month, and it seemed like they were saying Robbie was going to win because every month there was a new pictures of Robbie, and, you know, back then we had to wait each month for the magazine to see any pictures, and it seemed like to me every month Robbie was getting bigger and more ripped. I'm like, wow, this guy's going to be unbelievable by the time the contest gets here. And then they were also promoting Lou because Lou was in California, I think, all year training for the Olympia, training under Joe Weider, supposedly. So I thought the two of those guys. But then when I got to the show, because I went to see the show, I was only 14 years old, and Frank was like the most popular guy in the contest. Like the audience was going crazy for Frank. And Robbie showed up, and he was, like you said, he was retaining a lot of water. He didn't look as good as he did in the magazines. And he had this big afro, and the afro like kind of threw off everything. It threw off his physique. He just didn't look as good. He was very Robbie didn't have the charisma, you know. Like Zane was really projecting to the audience, where Robbie wasn't. Robbie seemed almost unsure of himself. So it was a real popular victory for Frank to win, I think.
Well, Robbie, of course, anyone who knows Robbie can tell you he's a very naturally introverted guy.
Yeah.
And the strange thing is Frank is too. But, you know, the way to describe Frank is he was kind of introverted in those days off the stage. In other words, he was, you know, not the super friendliest guy. I mean, he wasn't unfriendly, but he was one of those guys where if you didn't talk to him, he wouldn't talk to you. It was that type of deal?
Yeah.
But Robbie was even more introverted. But the difference was when Frank got on stage, he adopted another persona. You know, he focused on the posing. He projected his personality. Whereas Robbie couldn't shake that introversion, and it showed, see?
Yeah.
And he seemed unsure of himself. And I agree with you. All the magazines were projecting. I mean, Robbie was coming off a string of victories. Like I say, first
Night of the Champions was the next year, but he had already won Mr. Universe, Mr. International, Mr. America, Mr. World, I think. Yeah,
Robbie was considered like one of the top bodybuilders there. Yeah. And like you say, the magazines were all predicting Robbie. So it's kind of a surprise when, you know, at the actual contest, Robbie shows up. But this is what happened. Each time, it's almost like Robbie had a curse. Every time he looked great all the time. And then at the Olympia, he'd show up with that water, that sheen of water and lose.
Yeah, you know? Yeah.
You know? Of course, Robbie went on to win he was the first Masters Mr. Olympia. I was there. I mean, well, you know, and who did he beat? He beat Lou Ferrigno.
Yeah.
You know, so, you know, I'm sure he was happy about that, you know. But Robbie also believes that, I mean, if you speak to him today, he thinks that, you know, there was a certain amount of prejudice against him, mm-hmm. with, you know, despite the water. He felt that the deck was stacked against him. You know, he thinks there might be a racial component there. And also because he had some problems with Joe Weider, you know, concerning this, you know, this this stature that went like that.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, that it was basically Robbie's body. Unquestionably, Robbie was the model. And Joe put his head on the statue.
Right.
And the agreement he had with Robbie was that Robbie's head would go on the statue. And, you know, it was in the lobby of the Weider main office in Woodland Hills. And so when Robbie and his girlfriend attended the unveiling of the statue, they almost fell on the floor. I mean, because, you know, it's Joe Weider's head. Nobody told Robbie that they were using Joe, they were going to place his head.
Right.
Weider. And Robbie, to this day, you know, is very still angry about that. He's really pissed off about that. And because he felt it was a really underhanded move. And he kind of expressed his feelings about that. And, you know, so the bottom line is he feels that it was the second. In other words, he probably couldn't have won the title no matter how good he looked. That's the bottom line.
Yeah.
That's what Robbie thinks. I mean, you know, and that's a matter of opinion because, you know, as you said, Frank was very finished. It all depends what you were looking for. I mean, personally, I think, you know, that Frank deserved the 3 years that he won. He came in great shape, and, you know, he peaked on time. Everything was perfect for him.
Yeah.
He presented the best body possible for his structure. Based on that, I think he deserved it.
It's interesting what you say about his charisma, too, because I remember reading an article by Frank, and he was, like you said, a very smart guy. He learned a lot from all the shows he did. Right. And he said when he lost to Franco the year before in 76, he lost by half a point. It was so close. Right. But when he saw the pictures, he noticed that he wasn't smiling in any of the pictures.
Right.
So then the next year in 77, that was one thing he rectified. He always made sure he smiled during his routine. He projected his personality to the audience. And it really, I was there, man. The applause for Frank was unbelievable. The crowd was so pro Frank Zane. Right. You know, it was like everybody wanted him to win. And what was interesting, too, was when they did the announcements, they didn't go like 6th, 5th, 4th. Reg Park, I remember, was the MC, and he started with number one. He announced Frank first, which was really unusual.
That is unusual.
Yeah.
I don't know if I like that. I'd rather have it.
Yeah. But they never did it again. That was the only time they did it.
It kind of takes the excitement away.
I mean, right.
I mean, you don't have a contest like that between Frank and Robbie. Let's say it's close.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, wouldn't you want to wait till the last minute, you know,
to create
some tension with the audience?
Yeah.
But what you're saying is very true. I do think it's important to project a personality. I mean, you know, I see bodybuilders today, they go on stage and they're so intensely focused on their posing, they look like they hate the audience. They're practically grimacing. And, you know, the way the human mind works is, or, you know, if you project that you don't like somebody, even if you don't say anything, they don't like you.
Yeah.
Even if no words have said.
Right.
If you come off with a hostile look, it's like a switch goes on. I don't like this guy.
Yeah.
You know? And the funny thing is it works even on the bodybuilding stage. If you're like making dirty looks at the audience and not smiling, you're not going to be as – if you smile and look like you're having a good time, it relates to you and actually roots for you.
Yeah.
So Frank was smart enough to pick up on that.
Yeah.
And he was a very smart guy.
Yeah,
so,
he was.
You know, you can see what it did for it. It probably did play a role in his victory.
Yeah.
I
remember, too, when they announced second place, Reg Park made a mistake and he announced Ed Corney a second. And then Robbie was like, oh, you got to be kidding me. Not only do I not win, I didn't take second. And then he corrected it, and then he announced Robbie second. So Ed Corney went over and put his arm around him, gave him the check. So that was pretty funny.
That was on
Wide World of Sports too. So it got really good coverage. It got a lot of media coverage.
Was that Columbus, Ohio?
Yeah, that was the second year they had it in Columbus. Yeah.
Right. In fact, I don't remember which Olympia was it where Arnold was a commentator. I don't know if it might have been like the year after that, or in 79?
79, I think. I know what you're saying, yeah.
where he interviews, this is another Hallmark hit, historical bed bodybuilding, where Arnold, you know, in street clothes, that wasn't posing. He was a commentator for ABC, I think it was.
Yeah.
And Frank had just won the Olympia again. He goes backstage and he says, Frank, how do you feel about winning this? I guess it was the third time.
Third time, yeah.
Winning this three Mr. Olympias. And Frank looks at him and says, almost as good as it was beating you in 68, Arnold.
Right.
You know, if you can find that video, I'm sure it's somewhere on YouTube, take a close look at Arnold's face. Because for about 2 seconds, he lost his composure.
Right.
He didn't expect Frank to say that. He caught him completely off guard.
Right.
And his face, like, you know, it was just very brief. You got to look quick.
Yeah,
it's like, you know, and then, you know, he realized he was on camera because he just, you know, completely acted like he didn't hear. You know?
Right, right.
But I thought it was a hilarious moment, you know.
Yeah.
Frank gave him a little dig there, gave Arnold a taste of his own medicine.
Yeah.
That was something that Arnold would say to somebody
else.
Right,
right. Arnold does that all the time, right.
Exactly, right. Right.
And then Arnold's book, Education of a Bodybuilder, came out that year. And I remember Arnold went on this massive promotional tour, and he went to, I think he almost went to almost every state, you know, promoting it. He was at bookstores, and I remember they had long lines of people to wherever he was at. And then he was on Tonight Show, and he was on radio shows. So that was it. And it made the New York Times bestseller list, too.
Oh, it was a very good book. I remember I got the book right after it came out myself. You know, mm-hmm. I didn't get it from Arnold. I bought the book. And, of course, the co-author was a guy named Douglas Kent Hall, who actually, I guess it's no secret, he wrote the actual book.
Yeah.
Arnold basically, he interviewed Arnold, of course. I mean, it's not that the facts were wrong. Some of it was exaggerated in the book, but some of the events in the book were not quite with the way they were. But most of it was true because Arnold, this guy, Douglas Kent Hall, he interviewed Arnold and he wrote the book. It was a very good book and it was very popular. And, you know, Arnold told his life story coming from Austria and this and that. You know, it's interesting. Not quite as candid as some later biographies of Arnold. You know, which told, let's say, some of the darker events in Arnold's life.
Yeah.
You know, and also Arnold's own autobiography, which is, you know, I can't remember it. It just came out. You remember Arnold's autobiography?
Total Recall, it was called.
Total Recall, yeah.
Yeah.
Arnold kind of illuminated a lot of events, you know, that it was kind of looking back in his life that were not listed in that original book.
Yeah.
That's, I would describe that original book, Education of a Bodybuilder, it's kind of a fan book, you know,
mm-hmm.
letting the fans of Arnold know the details, how he got into bodybuilding and all the, you know, the great times he had and all that stuff. You know, it didn't have a lot of details about his training or his diet. It was just basically a personality book. But it was a good book. I don't know if it's still in print, if anyone can get it, but it's a good read. I mean, the guys who wrote it was a professional writer. It flows really good. It's a good book, if I say so myself. Yeah.
Were you surprised that made the bestseller list, Jerry? Because, I mean, bodybuilding was just starting to get popular, and I know all the bodybuilding fans all bought the book. But yeah. They just had something on Facebook the other day, and they showed it was a news clip from one of the states that he visited or one of the cities he visited, and it had him in a mall signing the book at a bookstore, and the line was like three blocks long down the mall. I mean, so it was like that everywhere he went. You know, he always had this long line of people, so he must have touched a nerve with that book where even the average person must have wanted to read it.
Do you recall the year the book came out?
77.
Okay. 77 now.
Yeah.
I have to ask you a question. Did that book come out before or after the Pumping Iron book? I don't recall. Do you know?
Well, Pumping Iron book came out in 74. So it was 3 years later, yeah.
There's your answer right there. That's why I want to ask you that. The Pumping Iron book set the stage for Arnold's popularity. In other words, if we assume that Education of a Bodybuilder came out before the actual Pumping Iron film, Arnold had already had kind of a name because, as you know, Pumping Iron was a surprise bestseller too.
Yeah.
You know, the actual book. So people knew about Arnold. Now, the Pumping Iron book was a general thing about bodybuilding, even though Arnold was a featured player. And it created a need where people found Arnold intriguing.
Yeah.
So when the Education of the Bodybuilder book came out, every bodybuilder purchased that book because everyone who knew who Arnold was. But because of the Pumping Iron book, there was an overlap where people wanted to learn more about Arnold. This guy is different, and he's you know, he can make fun of himself. He jokes around. He, you know, I want to know about this guy. So, you know, it kind of set the stage for that book to sell a lot, because it wasn't purchased only by bodybuilders. As you see, you know, with the lines you mentioned, it was purchased by the general public, who found Arnold a very intriguing character.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
So I think to answer your question, it was the Pumping Iron book that set the stage for the popularity of education of a bodybuilder. I think that's what. I think if the Pumping Iron book hadn't come out first, Arnold's book, every bodybuilder still would have bought it, but it might not have had that overlap with the general public.
Because
I recall seeing people reading that book back then who were not bodybuilders.
Yeah, yeah.
They, just reading the book, I remember the cover had Arnold in that famous shot, the side shot like that.
They
were reading the book because they were intrigued by Arnold. He's an intriguing personality, you know. They had never actually seen – they had these, like I said, preconceived notions of bodybuilders being single-minded on their muscles, where they literally couldn't talk, couldn't enunciate or say, you know, where if you said, hey, how you doing? They go, I like my body. You know, this was the conception. And then a guy like Arnold comes along who, you know, he can make fun of himself and self-deprecation, that's the word I was looking for. And you know, it was very intriguing to people, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And they wanted to know about this guy. He was unique and he stood out. So that's why I think the book sold so well.
Yeah. Did you ever hear that story about that year? It was in 77. He was supposed to be on the Tonight Show. Now, I think Arnold had been on the Tonight Show a couple times before, but it was when they had a guest host. It wasn't when Johnny Carson was the host.
Uh-huh.
And so this was the first time he was supposed to be on Johnny Carson's show, and he was promoting the book.
Yeah.
So I remember the story, and this really told me a lot about Arnold's belief in himself, his self-confidence, and his personality.
Yeah.
And Carson, I guess, at the last minute wanted Arnold to come on and take his shirt off, and then Carson was going to go and take his shirt off, and they were going to, you know, pose together. And now, this was in 1977, so Arnold was retired for 2 years, and he didn't look, you know, like he used to look.
Right.
But he wanted to portray a professional image, so he told Carson's people, he said, no, I'm going to go on Carson's show with the suit coat on, and I'm not going to take my shirt off. And they told him, they said, well, if you don't take your shirt off, you can't come on the show. And he said, okay, then I'm not going to go on the show. So I remember I was like a kid, I think I was in eighth grade, and in the newspaper, they would say, like, who was going to be on the Tonight Show. And I remember it said that day that Arnold was going to be on the Tonight Show. So I stayed up late that night, and I watched it. And when Ed McMahon came on and introduced who was going to be the guest, he didn't mention Arnold's name. So Carson comes out, and he does his whole monologue. And then he said, hey, for those of you who may have heard, Arnold Schwarzenegger was supposed to be on the show today, but he didn't want to come on the show because – we wanted him to pose, but this is what he looks like now. And they took a picture of Arnold's head from the book cover, and they put the skinny guy, you know. But I always thought that was really impressive about Arnold, that he stood up to Johnny Carson, who was the biggest biggest media star in the world back then. They only had three channels, remember, back then, NBC, ABC, and CBS. And that was the biggest talk show ever. And he had the chance now to go on the Tonight Show, and he stood up to him, and he said, no, I'm not going to do it. And then, of course, later on, Carson brought him back, and he became a really, really popular guest on The Tonight Show. And every time he had a book or a movie, he would promote it. And he really became good friends with Johnny Carson. But I thought that was really impressive of him, that he stood up for himself.
Well, it illustrates a couple of things about Arnold. First of all, Arnold's a natural for talk shows because he has a great gift of gab.
Yeah.
He has a sense of humor. And obviously, he always has that self-depreciation. We could, like, make fun of himself. He's a very entertaining guest, you know, and you know, the whether it's David Letterman or Johnny Carson, if you look at the old show, he always comes off good. They all, you know, very
cool.
But, you know, that story that you just told illustrates something about Arnold, is that he always had a business sense. So in other words, Arnold realized, remember, he's promoting the book, right? He wasn't in shape. People have a conceived notion, you know, that photo of him on the cover when he was a champion bodybuilder, you know, if he would have... they would expect him to look like that.
Yeah.
And, you know, if he had taken off the shirt, it would have been great for a comic bit because as even completely out of shape, he still would have made Johnny Carson look like a pile of crap. But Arnold knew that if he took off his shirt without appearing like even close to the way he looked in, let's say, the Mr. Olympia, it might actually, in some people's minds, they might say, this guy's a fraud. I'm not going to buy his book.
Right.
It's a book sale. So Arnold would have been stupid to do that. I mean, and my favorite thing about Arnold on a talk show, I don't know if you ever saw this, there was another show. This might have been around the same time. Tom Snyder, a guy named Tom Snyder.
I remember Tom Snyder.
It was called Night Something or Other. He had a show on NBC.
Yeah.
And one night he had not just Arnold, but Arnold's arch rival, Sergio Oliva.
I heard about this, I never saw it, but I heard about it.
To tell you what happened, he had both guys on the show, and, you know, they're talking back and forth, and you know, Arnold is, you know, using his sense of humor. And now Sergio suffered from the same problem that Robbie did, in the fact that it was very hard for him to show any sense of humor. Now, from what I understand, in past interviews, I think I told you, Sergio Sr. and I didn't get along. I met him three times. It was all bad, all the three occasions that I met him. It did not come off well. I'm very good friends with his son, Sergio Jr., has a completely different personality. But the point being that Sergio did not come off as a friendly, funny guy, and Arnold did. So, you know, they're bantering back and forth with Tom Snyder. Arnold's telling jokes about himself as usual. Sergio's seeming like this angry guy, you know. Mm-hmm. And then Tom Snyder has the idea to bring out an Olympic bar, bro. You know, I think it was about maybe 225 on the bar, 245-pound plates in each other. He says, okay, he says, you guys are rivals. Tom Snyder says, you guys are rivals. Now we're going to see who's the strongest guy. I want you guys to lift this weight and see who can lift it the most times. So Sergio steps forward immediately. Remember, Sergio was a former Olympic weightlifter from Cuba.
Right.
I mean, this is nothing to him, you know? So he takes the barbell and he presses it a couple of times. He puts it down, and Sergio then says, okay, now, you do it, Arnold. You know, he goes like that to Arnold. And Arnold says to Tom Snyder, he says, I'm not going to lift the weight. I'm a bodybuilder. I am not a weightlifter. I'm not. I don't claim to be a weightlifter. Sergio's face dropped. The corner was. I mean, Arnold just stood there. He says, "No, I'm not. Who says I'm a weightlifter? I'm a bodybuilder.
Right.
I don't claim to be a weightlifter." He let Sergio. The funny part. He let Sergio go through the motions, even though he had no intention. Arnold stood. He never said he would lift the weight.
Right.
You know. It was almost reminds me of the time when Arnold and Sergio competed, when, you know, the famous story when Arnold and Sergio were on stage and Arnold whispers to Sergio, you know, they were doing a post out. Arnold whispers, he says, that's okay. You know, it's done. Let's go off the stage. So Sergio exit and Arnold stays there and won the Olympia. You know what I mean?
Right.
It kind of reminded me. It was almost like a replay of that, because here Arnold has Sergio lift the weight, not saying that he wasn't going to do it, waits for Sergio to finish, and then says to Sam, I'm not a weightlifter. I'm not going to lift the weight. You know?
Right.
It's hilarious to see that. Sergio got so mad. He almost wanted to punch Arnold in the face. He was so angry that, you know, he could almost read Sergio, damn it, he did it to me again.
Hey, let's talk about some of the amateur shows that year. I want to talk about the AAU Mr. America. You know, I had Ken Sprague on my podcast.
That was a great interview. I listened to that.
Yeah. And Ken was the promoter, and he was the owner of Gold's Gym at the time. And I thought that was really an amazing show because he had an actual parade.
Oh yeah.
Before the Mr. America contest, were you in California at that time, Jerry?
I was in California, but I believe it or not, I don't know why I didn't see the parade.
Oh wow! Okay.
I think they might have had it really early in the day, and I used to train at the gym in the afternoon.
Yeah.
So I didn't actually see it. I know that Ken Waller rode an elephant.
Yeah, and Bill Grant was there too. Yeah.
Bill Grant was on a float with flowers in the background with his girlfriend. Her girlfriend's name was Kathy Blankley. You know, she was in a bikini. He was, you know, he was doing his famous bicep pose in there.
Yeah.
That was a singular event, as you pointed out in the interview. That was something that was a first and last in bodybuilding. I mean, it was really great promotion on the part of Ken Sprague, because nobody had ever seen that before. And like I say, it's never been done since.
Yeah.
And, you know, having these bodybuilders roll down the street, you know, a guy, you know, Ken Waller riding an elephant, this and that, you know.
Right.
I mean, it was a great way to promote the contest, because, again, people who didn't know anything about bodybuilding would see these guys and say, geez, they're going to be, maybe we should go to this show. And, you know, it's a way to draw people to the contest that might not otherwise attend it. I mean, with the shows back then, you already had an automatic audience of bodybuilders.
Yeah.
I mean, they would attend no matter what, parade or not. But, you know, Ken Sprague had his promotional type of mind where he saw an opportunity to bring up the ticket sales by getting people who might not even be interested in bodybuilding to attend the show because they might say to themselves, now let's see, these guys were in a parade, right? What the hell are they going to do with the contest? Maybe we should go. Maybe they're really fun to see, you know?
Yeah.
So, you know, kind of reminds me of my mother. My mother, when I used to visit New York, you know, my mother loved to go to Broadway plays, you know. So when I visited, we all go to, you know, one of the things we do is go to plays. I go to plays with my mother, Broadway, off-Broadway, off-Broadway. But she loved any kind of stage presentation. And I was working for Joe Leader, and I was covering what they used to call the Night of the Champions, right? Mm-hmm. This was in Maine, New York. I used to go every year. That was my contest to cover for many years because it gave me the opportunity to visit my family, you know. So, you know, I said to my mother one day, I said, well, I got to cover this contest. So she says, what do you mean? I said, well, it's a bodybuilding contest, Mom. You're not going to be interested. It's not a stage show. She says, does it have a stage? I said, yeah. She says, well, I want to go. So my mother attended this money, and she actually liked him.
Yeah.
But she embarrassed me, though, because I was sitting with her like in one of the first rows, and you know we're waiting for the contest to start, and this female bodybuilder who I think passed away, you probably know, she was real tall. She was a nice person. Nicole Bass. There you go. Right? Nicole Bass. Now, if you remember, Nicole Bass was like 6'2".
Yeah, yeah.
Big woman, right? And my mother's sitting there with me, and Nicole Bass walks by, and my mother blurts out, "What? That's a man! That's a man dressed in woman's clothes." What is it? Thank God that Nicole Bass didn't hear her, because I knew Nicole Bass.
Yeah.
It's a friend of mine. It would have been so embarrassing. Mom, don't say that. I had to crack up with the my mother insisted that was a guy, because she was, you know, really big woman. She had big hands and stuff.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
I mean, but she was a very nice person, Nicole. I'm not saying this to put her down, just that my mother had never seen female bodybuilders.
Right, yeah.
Here's this gigantic one who's 6'2" walking by. I mean, you know, what do you get? I mean, right. That's what I, you know. I mean, I'm sure that my mother was not the only person who accused Nicole of, I think even Howard Stern, when she's the one to help, he always used to ask if she was a man. Yeah. You know, it was like a standing joke, you know.
Yeah. Did you go to that Mr. America contest year?
I did. Yeah, I did go to that. That was won by Dave Johns, if I remember
correctly. Dave Johns, yeah.
Yeah, Dave Johns, he was an interesting guy. He was a great physique, terrific guy, very soft-spoken, quiet guy. You know, very friendly, but again, very introverted. You know what I mean? Kept himself. I can't remember what he did. He did some sort of either counseling or working with prisoners. I don't remember what his job was.
Yeah, youth counselor or something. Yeah, I think you're right.
Right. And I remember there's a funny story about Dave Johns. When he was training for that contest, you know, he had pretty good calves, you know, pretty good legs, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I said to him, hey, Dave, you know, because my calves were lagging. So, you know, I went up to him in the gym. This is when he was preparing for the 77 America. I said, Dave, what do you do for your calves? Can you tell me? Because I want to get my calves up, you know. He says, well, I do 30 sets of calves. I said, 30 sets of calves? I said, Dave, how do you do 30 sets of calves? He says, well, I just do them, you know. So about an hour later, I'm in the gym, and I see there's Dave Johns preparing to do calves. And he goes up to the calf machine, and he loads it up with weight. And then I see he does these like tiny little movements. He's, you know,
yeah.
And he did this standing. He did the seated calf raise, and all of his movements were like those. You know how they do those little partial calf raises?
Yeah, yeah.
I said, that's how he does 30 sets.
Yeah.
See, I couldn't figure out because when I trained calves, I did full movements. You know, all the way up, all the way down. My calves would lock up after about 12 sets.
Right.
I couldn't even raise my heels.
Right.
How does this guy do 30 sets? But you know what? To his credit, though, I have to say, he had pretty good calves.
Yeah.
I mean, it worked for him.
Yeah.
Really good.
All right. Thank you for listening to another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. Thanks again to Jerry Branum for joining us. He's always one of my favorite guests. And next week, we will have part two of our interview with Jerry, where we continue talking about the year 1977. And now, without further ado, I want to read this article called The Smallest Trophy He Ever Won, which is from the May 1977 issue of Muscle Builder and Power magazine. And it says, Mom has never seen him lose. And it's written by Janet Charlton. It says, the Hollywood Foreign Press Association's Golden Globes Award show is always more like a party than a ceremony. Pleasantly warmed by cocktails and dinner, the star-laden audience is relaxed and receptive, and the inevitable mistakes made during the live telecast add to the hilarity. So it's a lot more fun than the Academy Awards, and consequently, the really big stars show up. They also have a nice habit of recognizing newcomers, many of whom have since hit the big time and didn't forget. This is the category for which Arnold was nominated, Best Acting Debut in a Motion Picture Male. His competition was Lenny Baker for Next Stop Greenwich Village, Truman Capote for Murder by Death, Jonathan Kahn for The Sailor Who Fell from Grace with the Sea, and Harry Stevens for The Omen. Arnold was, of course, nominated for his performance in Stay Hungry. As usual, the Beverly Hilton Hotel lobby was jammed with hardcore fans and photographers craning their necks for a look into the arriving limousines. Arnold's mother had flown in from Austria 2 weeks earlier for the premiere of Pumping Iron in New York, and she was Arnold's date for the Golden Globe show. Actually, she rescued Arnold from a tight spot. Now he didn't have to choose one of his girlfriends as his date for the evening, thereby making all the other ones angry. United Artists sent a limousine to pick them up at Arnold's house in Santa Monica to get them to the Golden Globes in plenty of time for the cocktail party. When they arrived at the hotel, fans screamed, "It's Mr. Universe!" and girls begged to touch his muscles. Photographers leaped at him from all angles, and Arnold's mother, who only speaks a few words of English, smiled pleasantly through it all, barely understanding a word, but amused by all the action. Further spectacular entrances were made by Farrah Fawcett and Lee Majors. Women gasped, "She's even better looking in person." Charo swiveled in with a gentleman who bore no resemblance to Xavier Cugat. She hastily explained to reporters, "I don't fool around. He's my manager." Then she held up terrific posing for photographers from all angles until ushers had to scoot her along. As she passed Arnold at the bar, Charo looked him up and down and exclaimed, "Ay, ay, ay, he's a big fella." Young and Restless star Brenda Dixon popped eyes in her revealing John Kloss nightgown that didn't fool anyone. Palm trees in the lobby were knocked over, and there were rumblings of a riot when Henry Winkler walked in, looking surprised as usual by all the commotion. Grown men begged the Fonz for autographs. Later, Henry approached Arnold and was dead serious when he told him, "I really admired your performance in Stay Hungry. You're a very sensitive actor." Arnold thanked Henry and explained to his mother in German that Henry is one of the top TV stars in the United States. The biggest real movie star to show up that night was undisputably Sophia Loren. Her beauty and charm dazzled everyone. Arnold confided that Sophia impressed him as an extremely feminine woman, not just a lady or a girl, but a real woman. When she saw Sophia, Arnold's mother realized that she was somewhere special, not just out for a fancy dinner, and she started getting really excited. Meanwhile, Barbara Streisand and John Peters sneaked in the back door like thieves in the night to avoid having to be polite to anyone. Milling around the bar, sipping cocktails, were Nick Nolte, Henry Fonda, Sarah Miles, Carol Burnett, Jodie Foster. She came with her mother and wore no makeup and drank ginger ale, just like a well-brought-up 14-year-old. Lindsay Wagner and her new husband, Michael Brandon, necked like newlyweds, while James Stewart, Deborah Kerr, and Charlton Heston reminisced about the good old days. Peter Falk and Raquel Welch chatted about doing a movie together. The Osmonds passed up the bar, but Catherine Ross hung around to gossip with Laverne and Shirley stars Penny Marshall and Cindy Williams. They told Catherine she was a sure thing to win the Best Supporting Actress Award, and she did just that. Arnold got an eyeful of Valerie Perrine as she walked by in a dress slid up almost to her waist. Talia Shire told Arnold that she's been dying to go to Muscle Beach for the longest time. Would he please tell her the address? Sarah Miles complimented Arnold on his acting, gave him the once-over, and asked him how much he weighed. When the crowd drifted into the main ballroom for dinner, Arnold found that he was sitting near Sylvester Stallone, who's also a bodybuilder of sorts. Sylvester told Arnold there might be a great part for him in his new film he wrote called Hell's Kitchen. Shelley Winter stopped by Arnold's table to wish him luck. She had attended the New York premiere of Stay Hungry with Arnold. "So you're a big star now," she cracked. "How come I saw you in After Dark magazine with no clothes on?" she asked. "It was an oversight," admitted Arnold, "but I doubled their circulation for that issue." When asked why both she and her boyfriend wore tuxedos, Linda Carter replied, "The invitation said black tie." Tybalt Shepherd ate Peter Bogdanovich's dessert because he's on a diet. Two wide-eyed girls swore they took a wrong turn and ended up in the men's room with Arnold. The bathroom attendant chased them out. Arnold was perfectly calm when the live televised portion of the award show began after dinner. Then the publicity people from United Artists started straightening his tie, picking lint off his suit, and telling him to relax. Then he started getting nervous. Master of Ceremonies Harry Belafonte panicked the foreign press when he lost his voice just before showtime, and he had to have a double vodka rushed to him backstage. After the winners were announced and picked up their awards, they stopped backstage to have their pictures taken in the photo room. Henry Winkler was by far the most thrilled winner. He kept repeating, "I don't believe it. Do I really get to take it, this Golden Globe, with me?" Barbara Streisand and John Peters kept courting their awards, asking, "Do we have one too many?" Much to the surprise, the photographers abandoned Barbara when Sophia walked into the photo room. As the two women passed in the doorway, they looked at each other's chest. King Kong's sexy leading lady, Jessica Lange, won the Best Female Acting Debut Award. She shyly asked photographers backstage, "Do you want me?" And can you imagine the answer she got? Sylvester Stallone led the applause when Arnold was announced as winner. When a reporter asked Arnold if his mother was surprised that he won, Arnold replied, "To tell you the truth, I doubt it. My mother has never seen me lose." While Arnold was backstage posing with his award in the photo room, Raquel Welch passed by, stopped dead in her tracks, walked back, and seemed to be undressing Arnold with her eyes. She volunteered to shoot some pictures with him, much to Arnold's unconcealed delight, and ended up feeling his muscles and sitting on his shoulder. It is rumored that they exchanged phone numbers later. Could this be the start of something big? The last award announced was for Best Picture, and Arnold was delighted when his friend Sylvester Stallone's film Rocky won. Stallone went crazy, tore up his centerpiece, and threw flowers in the air and kissed everyone in sight that was female. It was a happy night, and most important, it stimulated interest and respect for the sport of bodybuilding. After the Golden Globes and the success of Pumping Iron, United Artists decided to re-release Stay Hungry. Only this time, Arnold's picture is prominently displayed since he's become so famous, and its ads describe the movie as a film about men pumping iron. It's a direct ripoff of Arnold's latest film and confusing to the public. It just goes to show you the power of publicity. The first time Stay Hungry was released, Arnold's name was rarely even mentioned as a featured player. Now he's getting better billing than the star, Jeff Bridges. Since he retired from bodybuilding competition, Arnold says that reporters continually ask him, "What are you going to do next, now that you're not a winner anymore?" Now Arnold can point proudly to his Golden Globe and say, "I am still a winner, as this award shows." All right, that was great. That was great hearing about all the old stars. It was also great reading about Arnold and Stallone meeting for the first time. This was, wow, 40 years ago, 42 years ago, and now they're still good friends. And that movie that Stallone was talking about, he called it Hell's Kitchen. It was actually Paradise Alley, which I believe was released in 1978. I think it was the second movie he did after Rocky in 1976. So that's interesting. And that was a movie about wrestlers. So he must have been thinking of Arnold for a part as wrestlers. And I forgot about that thing with Raquel Welch. But they got some great pictures in here with Arnold holding up Raquel Welch. And wow, I wonder if he did exchange numbers with their lucky dog. So anyways, that is our article. Sort of kind of a short one, but it was a really good one. We will see you guys next week. Thank you to Old School Labs for sponsoring this episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. And we will have Jerry Branham on next week, part two of our interview, where we talk about the year 1977 in bodybuilding. Have a great week, everybody. Take care.